them in America is more like a black box. Even the people who work inside the university are not properly aware of its conditions. Of course, the only obvious thing is the increasing number of young people entering universities. Young people and their families have to borrow from banks if they have not saved extra money for education. Banks take a financial commitment from students in exchange for paying the tuition fees. This financial commitment is considered in installments of several years. There is also another point. The interest of this amount of money increases day by day, and if students don't get a job, they will have to pay back more. So the figure that Bernie Sanders mentioned in his speech was not so unusual.
There is now more than $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. And this isn't just some sort of, you know, young person millennial issue. This really touches every facet of American lives, both individuals, their communities, our economy, and our country.
Their rankings made them to be a model for other scientific centers in the world. According to this institution, the rating criteria can be summarized in several points: the number of Nobel and Fields medals, the number of influential researchers, and the number of scientific articles. Although the criterion places American universities at the top of the list, there are other issues. The question is, how reliable are these ranking lists? In the last 40 years, the number of professors in relation to students has remained constant, but the number of managers and administrative staff has increased in relation to students. On the other hand, the official employment of professors is somehow over. Now, most of the university professors work under a contractual agreement and live in economic insecurity. The current situation is the result of neoliberals in power, like Ronald Reagan.
Conservative governors, especially Governor Reagan of California, had really run on the idea that higher education was a wasteful way to spend taxpayer money. Governor Reagan actually said the state should not subsidize intellectual curiosity. And he ran for president later on a promise to disband the Department of Education.
Certain advisors started to say that anything of a private advantage should be paid for.
The word free is one of the most misused words. We speak of free education. Education isn't free, it costs money.
If this is something that is going to be good for individuals to get a job and earn more money, they should finance it and make the investment themselves.
We need to keep government on the sidelines. Let the people develop their own skills, solve their own problems.
We stopped expanding the franchise of higher education, graduation rates stopped rising, and access for the poor to higher education started going down.
Politicians like Ronald Reagan divided people into two classes. Their ideal society consisted of two classes: the rich and the poor. They believe that the more people live in economic insecurity, the more docile they become. This dangerous attitude changed the structure of universities in general.
The government will make $184 billion in profits over the next 10 years. All those profits made off the backs of our kids who are trying to get an education.
Now, other universities are more like business enterprises than scientific centers. When academic goals give way to economic goals, something terrible happens to universities. In this time, students are considered customers. Universities need students' tuition, and students need university degrees. Universities try to provide relative satisfaction to students, and students owe money to banks to achieve university degrees. Statistics show that in 1960, only 15% of American students received top academic grades. But today, the story is different. Now, 43% of students receive top academic grades. Of course, this unprecedented growth in statistics does not mean that students are becoming more educated, but it means that universities go easy on them. In simpler terms, universities sell grades to students. The commercial approach to higher education has changed the relationship between professors and students. According to a study, 25% of seniors have never spoken to their professors outside of the classroom. Students don't respect and prize their professors so much, and the effort to acquire knowledge has been replaced by selling grades. Turning the university into a business enterprise has another aspect as well. On the one hand, universities have to provide new facilities to attract customers every year, and on the other hand, these facilities require large budgets. For several years, university administrators have been doing everything to earn more money. This money can sometimes be used to build a swimming pool and sometimes to buy useless items. Students' tuition fees are not alone enough to buy such equipment. Another way to earn money is college sports. At first, we may think that university leagues are held for athletic aims. But the reality is something else. In recent years, prominent sports brands and companies have been using the university's social capital. Sponsorship in exchange for advertisement is what Nike and Adidas are doing. College sports are no longer for the personal and professional growth of students, but for commercial purposes. Companies are the real owners of universities. Universities buy expensive athletes to win against other teams. They win in tournaments and become more famous and receive more money from sponsors.
The philanthropists of the Gilded Age gave us the idea of mass higher education as a basic human right. Peter Cooper was this industrialist who believed in education as free as water and air. He founded the Cooper Union, a school of industrial arts and design in New York City, with the idea that it would be available to people, no matter what their background, to study useful and practical arts. But today, the Cooper Union is one of the last examples of a free higher education institution in the country.
A full scholarship for every enrolled student is the current mission statement of Cooper Union.
Peter Cooper wanted the school to be accessible to the working class, to women, to people of color. I come from a lower middle class family. My parents told me about Cooper, and when I found out, I was like obsessed. I didn't even think about going anywhere else.
Nowadays, so much is against this 19th century model of a free education. Ideologically, financially, it's ancient.
New economic policies have changed everything over the decades, including the free education in some universities in the United States. In the middle of the 19th century, when Peter Cooper founded the Cooper Union, he had no other goal than free education. He rented properties to offset the costs of the university to achieve his goal. But everything changed 150 years later.
Money, money, money. After 18 months of intense analysis, the Board of Trustees voted last week to charge tuition for all undergraduates admitted to Cooper Union beginning with the class of 2014.
In 2011, the then president of Cooper Union declared that the costs were so high that they had to end free tuition policy. Students started protesting after hearing the decision. Some of them decided to take real actions. They could only occupy the university president's office.
We, the students of the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art, can no longer uphold or endorse the direction our college has taken under the leadership of Jamshed Barucha. By voting no confidence today, join us in keeping Cooper Union free to all.
Protests over monetizing higher education don't only take place in the U.S. In March 2018, students launched protests in Santiago, the capital of Chile. They protested against the government's new decision. The Chilean government decided to allow universities operate for profit, and this meant the end of free education.
In Chile, students have clashed with police in the capital, Santiago. They say the president's educational reform plan hasn't gone far enough. The government is improving teachers' pay and giving additional funds for poor students, but hasn't given the free university education students are demanding.
The protests in Chile soon turned incredibly violent. People who wanted to make money from education were not willing to change their minds. Private universities were considered a major challenge for some countries. Across a span of years, private institutions have emerged in Brazil, but their aim was not educational at all. These institutions provide loans to students to begin higher education. Of course, the repayment of these types of loans is the same as in the U.S. Students who receive this loan must work during the day and go to university at night. Otherwise, they can't repay their loans.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1,
For many of us, it was the first time being in the president's office. We have like this red light that we show to say that we're occupying the space.
Students at the Cooper Union did not stop their strike for the same reason. They occupied the then Cooper Union president's office for several months. Repeated talks with the students were not fruitful because the university officials did not want to change their decision.
Now, I know this has been a difficult time for the Cooper Union community. There is anger, there is disappointment over the tuition issue, but the debate you're having really isn't about whether education is free. It's really a debate about who can and who is willing to pay for it. There's nothing really free in life.
University officials did not consider free education as the right of the people. The students also decided to continue their protests in another way. After 65 days of sit-in protest, the demands of the students were almost fulfilled. But it only lasted 2 years. The board of directors of Cooper Union unanimously decided to demand tuition for students. Consequently, the free education became a myth. Until a few decades ago, it was difficult to get a university degree, and academic goals were considered the most important motivation for students. But everything changed with the emergence of capitalist ideology. Now, university degree is nothing but a product. Achieving a degree is possible not by hard work, but also by other means, Education has systematically tried to inculcate credentialism. Most jobs require a college degree, and one should pay money to get it. Writing articles, research papers, and having new ideas are not that much important now. Today, students are concerned about repaying loans, finishing their studies, and getting degrees. A university degree is only considered a value, and it is not important how you get it.
When you look at higher education, what you realize is what you're paying for is this mythical, large bundle of things that you're supposed to get. So I'm here to give you a framework to look at what types of services you could be accessing that could either supplement or kind of replace going to college. So I've unbundled college into three parts. The first is engaging with content you're supposed to learn. So it could be through a lecturer and transferring content to you. Then there's an affiliate network, enduring relationships with people that are going to look out for you, that are going to help you find opportunities. And the third is a credential of accepted value, which is literally a piece of paper that kind of certifies that you have met some minimum level of competency. When I went to school, there was no way to access the services that higher education provided easily and freely or cheaply on the internet. And it turns out, well, now you kind of can.
Of course, there are people who believe that the age of university is over. They believe that the education should be hacked like a computer system. Their goals became more clear in San Francisco. They withdraw from the university and believe that learning sciences and making connections with others are not exclusive to the university. They consider a university degree as a piece of paper only for self-glorification. What is important for them is to acquire real skills and relationships. In this method, they forget about the normal ways. They don't endanger their future by getting loans. This is a practical and useful way of learning. These people try to stand against the university that acts like an industry that makes a profit by unethical methods.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhana
The first sparks of Islamic revolution were essentially lit in Muharram and inspired by teachings of Ashura movement. Imam Khomeini says, "The martyrdom of the leader of the oppressed as well as oppressors, supporters of the Quran on the day of Ashura marked the beginning of the everlasting life of Islam and the Quran. The honorable Doyan of Martyrs fought for Islam with those youth and companions, all of whom gave their lives and revived Islam. It is Muharram and Safar that have kept Islam alive. It is the month of Muharram. Keep this Muharram alive. Whatever that we have is from this Muharram and these gatherings."
B Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we try to shed light on some sentences of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. Well, on the subject of Ashura and the movement of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, said, "The revolution of Ashura emerged at the hands of the master of martyrs, who by sacrificing his own blood and the blood of his dear ones, saved Islam and justice, and condemned the rule of the Umayyads, and demolished its rules and foundations." This sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, as you know, is just about the great sacrifice of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. To make sacrifice is to give away something, often precious, in order to achieve something greater. Often the reward of that sacrifice is not found in the near future. The goal of sacrifice is purification of the self and thereafter of the society. One of the most beautiful examples we have of sacrifice is that of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the Lord of Martyrs. Imam Hussein alayhi salam was one of the greatest revolutionaries ever. Although he was not successful physically, he was successful spiritually and religiously. Through Imam Hussein's sacrifice, many people come to realize that the Islam of the Bani Umayyah was not the true Islam, and many return to the path of Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The point Imam rahmatullah alayhi is making here refers not only to the society of the time of our holy Imam, but also to all the times, including the contemporary history of Iran. So we should take the lesson to sacrifice our beloved possessions for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and our religion as well. About the subject of Ashura and the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "The revolution of Ashura emerged at the hands of the master of martyrs, who by sacrificing his own blood and the blood of his dear ones, saved Islam and justice, and condemned the rule of the Umayyads, and demolished its rules and foundations."
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 29th verse of chapter Nur.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. ليس عليكم جناح أن تدخلوا بيوتا غير مسكونة فيها متاع لكم والله يعلم ما تبدون وما تكتمون.
There is no blame upon you for entering houses not inhabited, in which there is convenience for you. And Allah knows what you reveal and what you conceal.
Brothers and sisters, as we said, from the 27th verse forward, the points mentioned in the verses changed and somehow turned to mentioning some regulations of morals, how to control these regulations and how the people should have self-control over themselves when specifically they want to treat and have relations with other members of the society and community. The Muslim community must preserve itself from any kind of corruption. So that's why they have to observe some rules, some regulations, some morals in order to save their society. So, in the 27th verse, it was stated that there are some social orders that are really closely related to saving chastity, saving purity of the members of community, and it is how to enter people's home. This is a very important issue. And in the 28th verse, it was said that you do not need any permission if it was for your own house, and if you do not find anyone in it, it does not mean that the permission is granted. It does not necessarily mean the permission is given to you. فَلَا تَدْخُلُوهَا حَتَّى يُؤْذَنَ لَكُمْ. So you do not have to enter until permission is given to you. وَإِن قِيلَ لَكُمْ فَرْجِعُوا فَرْجِعُوا. If you are told to turn back, if you are rejected, you have to return. There is no worries. You do not have to get upset about this because there are some reasons that you do not need to be curious about. Because the landlord knows better when he or she needs to receive some guests. Now, in the 29th verse, it is said, ليس عليكم جناح أن تدخلوا بيوتا غير مسكونة فيها متاع لكم. It is no sin for you that you enter uninhabited houses wherein you have some goods. Public places that have no special inhabitants, such as hotels, such as shops and baths, which are open to all and people can enter and enjoy their advantages, are treated differently than personal homes. These places require no permission for entrance, and specifically, if you have some goods, if you have some items in there, you do not need to ask for permission. ليس عليكم جناح. It is no sin for you. So, In view of the fact that each ordinance has some exceptions through which problems and difficulties are solved rationally, in this verse, it is solved in this way, that you do not need to ask for permission if you are entering uninhabited houses.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Brothers and sisters, entering a place is so important in Islamic view that the Holy Quran says Allah knows what you reveal and what you conceal. This means entering public places needs some specific rules. You need to consider that the Almighty Allah, you need to consider the fact that the Almighty Allah is totally aware of all your thoughts, all your actions, and what you do and what you want to do. Because the verse says, يَعْلَمُ مَا تُبْدُونَ وَمَا تَكْتُمُونَ. He knows what you reveal and what you conceal. This phrase perhaps refers to this matter, that some individuals may sometimes misuse this exception and enter uninhabited homes on the pretext of this ordinance to find out some secrets. Or they sometimes enter some inhabited houses on the excuse that they did not know they are inhabited. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is aware of all these affairs. He knows well about those who misuse and going to public places while having no beneficial aim and only for wandering and going on about is often forbidden. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center,
The Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, but the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor. Its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
Let's talk about Dimona. Many people say, well, nobody knows.
You see, I blush, you say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But why? Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo, it's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex away from the public eye employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers. And we go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with this element of weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical, and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
Want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world?
Just transmitted at the request of the...
Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching a nuclear plant is a high risk. The highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. A barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
They said don't go off the road.
Finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. An exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona Nuclear Plant. Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona nuclear plant. And all of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
It was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a civic center of research, what it was called, a civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you built something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, you see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile things, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph. While the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time, the security eye was not that strong. So I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover. You can go up to the roof under cover. There's a kind of.
This message is transmitted at the request of the Quran.
When President Kennedy took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the US Secretary of Defense informs the president that based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying, and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the 6 floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we traveled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xantha Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xanthia Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona, its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact, what are they doing about cooling, where is the nuclear waste being stored, how is it being stored, and all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty, a way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media, and so on. So we know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what conditions. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is more better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better.
But there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Daria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Daria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up, and at that point it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my, estimations are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor, and the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take lead samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel? And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one of funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel,
because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. This is, if they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they are more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al Khalil Hills, there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. This and many other cases come from the same region.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a question, very delicate, kind of controversial. And that question is related to one of the pseudosciences or occult sciences known as astrology. As you know, there's a difference between astronomy and astrology. Astronomy is the science of the genesis, destruction, and movement of heavenly bodies, such as planets and stars and these kind of things. But astrology is a field where they study the effects that the movement of these bodies and their placement in the skies have on a person's faith, which, you know, pretty much everybody these days is aware of. And as you know, we have many traditions which kind of dissuade us from pursuing and investigating into, astrology and not listening to the predictions of the astrologers. Like, for example, one hadith is the following. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "O people, beware of learning astrology, except for that which is used for guidance in the land or the sea." So this is an allusion to astronomy, meaning studying the stars so you can be aware of, you know, your place in the earth or where you are in the sea, which is what they used to do in the past. Obviously, these days it has another function. In any case, then in continuation, the Imam said, "Because it," meaning astrology, "leads to divining, and an astrologer is like a diviner, and the diviner is like a sorcerer. And a sorcerer is like the disbeliever, and the disbeliever will be in hell." So the question we want to pose is, why have we been dissuaded from pursuing such a science? Or what is the reason for this? Or in what situations, let's put it this way, what situations would we should we avoid pursuing these kind of things? It's interesting that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam himself was asked about this. When asked about what was popularly held among people that the studying of the stars was prohibited and harmful to religion, he answered in the following way. "It is not as they say. It does not harm your religion." He then said, "You are looking into something," meaning